low moral fiber.
I don't think you should drink that.
First of all, welcome.
Hello.
Holding it like an inch or two in front of my mouth.
It looks bad for you.
You did it backwards.
All right. Nonsense. It makes me feel great.
And
that's pretty good.
I do want to know how much it costs per sip.
All right.
Can I keep his head for a souvenir?
I like it.
Hello, filthy humans, and welcome to another episode of Men of Low Moral Fiber, the show that almost always uses real diamonds in our chronojohns. I am Ben Helms, and your host, and with me, as always, is my human-sympathizing co-host and big brother, Jason Helms. How's it going, man?
I mean, how can you not like the humans? They're so non-squishy and slimy.
Oh, true.
It's just kind of a... I just really enjoy that about them. It's going well. I played a game this week, and that was fun.
Yeah. It lasted a little more than a week, didn't it?
Yeah. It did. It really did.
Yeah. Well, today we're going to talk about that game. It's a game that's very special to us, very near and dear to the hearts of the Helms family. It's a game that not only did we spend a lot of hours this week and last week and the week before on, but a lot of hours in our childhood on. And it's probably the game I remember more than any other LucasArts game before we even started this podcast, and that is Maniac Mansion 2... Day of the Tentacle, which I actually don't think that it actually has the word Maniac Mansion 2, but it's Maniac Mansion, Day of the Tentacle, or as my daughter would say,
Day of the Tentacle. That is heartrendingly cute.
Just add a little reverb to a two-year-old.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah, anything else you got about the game?
So Maniac Mansion came out in 1987, and a lot changed in the 6 years before Day of the Tentacle came out.
Yeah.
So 1993, Day of the Tentacle. And you're right. At first, it was definitely Maniac Mansion 2, Day of the Tentacle. But by the time it was released, I'm pretty sure it was just advertised as Day of the Tentacle.
Yeah, I mean, that's what everyone calls it anyway. No one calls it. I forgot it was even called Maniac Mansion, Day of the Tentacle. But yeah, you're right. That Day of the Tentacle subtitle just kind of took over the branding for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, today we're going to do our intro check, then we're going to talk about kind of what the game meant to us, what we thought about the game before we started doing research, then we're going to talk about all the research we did, kind of what the game was in 1993, what happened after it was released, the gameplay, obviously the gameplay because we spent a lot of time on that, then a few other surprises. Let's go ahead and jump into it. Some of the history of Day of the Tentacle. You got anything?
So this game, Day of the Tentacle, was created by Dave Grossman and Tim Schafer. Both would go on to do some amazing work in video games. Tim Schafer is probably more well-known than Dave Grossman. But both of them got their start as assistants on Monkey Island. I think they carried over a lot of the same humor from the Monkey Island games.
Did you see Tim Schafer's, I think it's his Wikipedia page where it shows, obviously, his, like, not filmography, chronology of all the LucasArts games he'd worked on. Did you see what he started as?
No. Oh, a scumlet?
What'd you say?
Scumlet? Oh, I was ready to get into scumlets, don't you
worry. I don't even know what that is yet. Oh, I'm so behind.
That's a thing.
No, he actually started out on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the action game, in 1989. He started out as a game tester originally and then worked himself up the ranks from there.
And there's a great thing about Tim Schafer. I think it was Tim Schafer who applied to get in and...
Yeah.
He knew the interview went terribly.
Yep.
And so he drew a little cartoon of him getting the job, like the interview going bad and them hiring him anyway. And he sent that to, I don't remember who it was, maybe David Fox, somebody at LucasArts. And they were like, hey, that's pretty funny. We should get him in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's hilarious because they had enough artists, they had enough designers, and they were just kind of like, we just need someone that stands out, someone that's different.
And did he ever stand out?
Yeah, so he went on to do, you said the Monkey Islands, he did Full Throttle eventually.
Yep.
And then probably the biggest LucasArts game, I think the biggest one ever, Grim Fandango.
Yeah.
Which was just huge. That was kind of his game. He did the writing, he did a lot of the art for it, he did all of the directing, everything on that one.
Yeah, and he recently re-released it. Grim Fandango is widely recognized as one of the best adventure games of all time. So it got re-released last year or the year before.
Yeah.
And it kind of led to what's coming up now that I'm sure we'll talk about a lot is, Day of the Tentacle will be re-released, in March. It looks like.
Yeah. March, 2016 for those listening 30 years from now.
Yeah.
And actually Full Throttle was announced this week, last week, early 2016 at least, or late 2015, that it is going to be re-released also. So they're remastering all of these old LucasArts games. And basically, well, this is like way later in my notes, but let's dive in. Basically, the big thing that they're doing is just bringing up the resolution, right? I mean, the artwork, it looks exactly the same other than less jagged edges.
Yeah.
When I looked at the screenshots.
One of the articles I saw about it said, you know, don't think of this as a new game or as a remake. Think of it as the Criterion Collection, where they're going to remaster it. But think of it that way as well with director's commentary, because they include interviews with a lot of the people who were instrumental on it. So I think Dave and Tim, and then some other people as well. Go on.
I was just going to say that was the coolest thing. I don't think I would play these games because we just played them. But I probably wouldn't pay $20, $30, $40 for just a reskinned version, except for those commentaries. I think I will just for those commentaries. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'm totally in on it. And you know what? You're going to be totally in on it because the version of this game that you played was the floppy disk version, which means you got no audio for most of the game.
Yeah, that sucked. I got a couple cutscenes. I got Green Tentacle and Purple Tentacle talking at the beginning, and I got the whole cutscene with the main characters and Bernard and all that. And then just nothing for like 12 hours. It was pretty rough.
So let's back up for a second. We're going to talk about the audio in this game and how important that was. But first, I think a really important question, and one that begs a audio bump, a little music play in at some point in the future, is what is a scumlet? A question you asked just a moment ago.
Oh my gosh, how do I not know this yet?
I know, this is exciting. And I'm stealing this from Rogue Leaders, Rob Smith's book about LucasArts. So what happened is that, you know, that first group of Ron Gilbert and I'm forgetting a name here and I'm embarrassed. Gary Winnick. Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick, you know, they created Scum. They started it. The great thing about Scum is that it was an engine, so you could use it to create a bunch of other games. And then, like we just talked about, they started bringing new people into LucasArts. LucasArts started to grow. And as people would come in, they would put them through this kind of boot camp of learning to use the Scum engine and learning to create with the Scum engine. And from the sound of it, it was actually pretty difficult. It was fun, but it really was kind of a boot camp for about a month, month and a half, where you were just doing coding and learning some stuff that you'd never seen before. And to haze the people who were coming in, they called them all scumlets. And the deal was you couldn't have the word scumlet, the title scumlet, removed from you until you were the director of your own game.
Jeez.
And so I saw a great interview with Tim Schafer where he said, you know what, none of us wanted to have scumlet removed from our names. Like, we were really proud of that. We loved it.
Right.
And so it was it sounds like it was a great place to work.
That's kind of what everything I'm reading, and not just from Rogue Leaders, which is obviously has hundreds of interviews from people that work there and kind of seems like an inside job, you know. But just from other interviews at Comic-Con and just, you know, it's 20 years later now, you'd think some dirt would finally come out. But we obviously knew a couple of people that worked, not at a couple of people at LucasArts, but at Lucasfilm as well. And it just seemed like, for the most part, it seemed like a really collaborative, open, and just kind of like very creatively generous place to make these revolutionary games.
Absolutely. So you've got Dave and Tim, the little scumlets who helped out on Secret of Monkey Island and the Secret of Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge. And they were the assistants on those games. And then they were given their own title. They were going to be project managers on a title together. And I think their senses of humor really clicked. People knew that these two were really going to do something fun and interesting. But, and I think this comes through a lot in the game, I think people were kind of worried about what they might make as well. And that's why they were tasked with making a sequel. How much trouble can they get into if we just give them a sequel? And the answer was
a bit. It seemed like there was a lot. Yeah, that's true. No hamsters were harmed in the making or duration of this game, but it does seem like there was a lot of emphasis on the pre-production compared to the previous games.
Yeah.
Where Tim and Dave and Ron and Gary, Tim Schafer, Dave Grossman, Ron Gilbert, and Gary Winnick, a bunch of random names, all got in a room for months, and they just kind of planned every single thing out. They went through every single puzzle, took the puzzles and gave them to other people at LucasArts and Lucasfilm, had them go through the puzzles to kind of just test QA every single puzzle that they were going to do before they even started actually diving into Scum and making the game.
And two really important things about the puzzles for these games. The first is that they really sought out to make it so you couldn't get stuck and you couldn't die. There was no losing here. And they tried that with Maniac Mansion and it hadn't happened. You
right.
could get
yeah,
stuck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's weird. That was 6 years before. And I know when we did the Maniac Mansion pod, I think we touched on that. But this, I saw a few places, this was listed as the first game, first LucasArts game ever to have that never die, never get stuck philosophy.
Yeah. And I think that's a really
important doesn't necessarily
one.
Just make it an, that doesn't make it an easy game by any means.
No, absolutely not. And so one of the other amazing things about this game was the, at least this was amazing to me, I don't know how innovative it was, but it was really impressive the use of time travel as a puzzle element. And that occurred to them pretty early on that this is how it was going to work, but it's amazing. I don't want to give anything away in terms of these puzzles. If you haven't played it, you'll just enjoy. It's something like if you needed moldy cheese, then you could put regular cheese somewhere and then somebody else would get it in 200 years and it would be really moldy. And that's the kind of idea behind some of these puzzles. My example was terrible. Theirs are much funnier.
Right. True. Yeah, no, they have some really good. We might have some spoilers later on, but we'll save those till at least like a half an hour in just to kind of weed those people out.
Wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I agree. I mean, it's revolutionary, just kind of like Maniac Mansion was the first Scum game. This was kind of like the next echelon of Scum games. It was the last one to have that one-third of the screen covered in verbs, that interface that it was made so famous through the Indiana Jones games, Monkey Island games. And while later versions had the one-third of the screen, they had kind of cheats around that. Like Sam and Max had the right click for like look at and talk to and pick up and that kind of ones that you use more often. So this was kind of that last inconvenient Scum game, I should say.
Yep. And the version I played did have right click. I'm not sure which version
bastard.
Of that. I know. It might have been CD-ROM or Jeez. It may have been a later version of it that came out. But I mentioned two important things, two influential things. The first was the no-lose philosophy, and the second was the use of audio and spoken audio in this game.
Right.
You know, it certainly had been done before. In fact, speech had existed in games all the way back to Atari, but it was usually a few words, a catchphrase, something like that. And then with the King's Quest games, they had released a couple, I believe, at this point that included spoken audio in a pretty similar way to Day of the Tentacle, where characters talk to each other. During cutscenes, you might see something, but also while a character is interacting, rather than the character's text just saying, I don't want to pick that up, the character would actually say, I don't want to pick that up. But with those King's Quest games, they kind of sounded like the way I just said it, because the people doing it were not professional actors. They were the programmers, the friends of the programmers, and so on. With Day of the Tentacle, they actually went to Hollywood, talked to agents, and got real, actual voice actors for the video game. And that seems really obvious now, but at the time that was strange and weird and a great, interesting idea that I think really makes this game.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's easy to look back at games now or from this perspective, 22, 23 years later, and think that it's cheesy. But the whole thing is I think one of the quotes from the Rogue Leaders book is it's basically just a Chuck Jones type video game. Yeah. Like it's a cartoon and it's supposed to be a cartoon. It's not trying to be a realistic Call of Duty or what Assassin's Creed, like real characters. Like they're trying to be funny cartoons and the voices that are doing them sound like very realistic cartoon funny voices.
Yeah.
I mean, they sound professional.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, one of them, they're trying to figure out who they might want and can you describe in your head, who should be the voice for Bernard? And Dave and Tim were talking about who should be the voice for Bernard. And Dave said, this is Dave Grossman, said, it should be like that guy from WKRP in Cincinnati, Les Nessman, the kind of nerdy guy.
right, that guy.
That Richard Sanders plays. And this was a popular show, not at the time, but it had been closer to that time.
20 years before, yeah.
Pretty soon, the person who was doing the actual casting said, well, actually, I know Richard Sanders' agent. They brought him in, and he became Bernard. And it was kind of nice that lined up, that they went, you know who I'm really envisioning? Is X, and then X came in.
Right, it was basically the main character. Probably has the most lines out of any character.
And I think he really makes the game.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, we should get into, we've kind of talked around it for the first 10 or 15 minutes. We should get into the actual just plot of the game. Maybe a quick summary so we don't have to dive in, obviously. But before we get to gameplay, what is Day of the Tentacle? What's the setup?
Well, you may remember from Maniac Mansion that there are two tentacles in the Maniac Mansion. There's a purple tentacle named Purple Tentacle, and there's a green tentacle named Green Tentacle. And
I mean, these are just creative guys locked in a room creating.
Yeah.
How can you blame them for such creative names?
Sometimes you don't know when the muse will strike.
Right.
Or where.
Right.
But I think it's clear that, that the muse struck, and the muse struck hard with the name Purple Tentacle.
Yeah.
At least our humor is dry. Anyway.
Yeah, this is true.
So the game starts out with Purple and Green Tentacle hanging out by the river that runs past the Maniac Mansion, where Dr. Fred has some kind of evil machine dumping toxic sludge into the river because he's terrible. And Purple Tentacle gets the bright idea of drinking the toxic sludge. It gives him this amazing superpower called arms. And now that Purple Tentacle has arms, he decides to go out and conquer the world. So our heroes enter. We have Bernard Bernoulli.
Bernoulli.
Why did I say his last name when I don't know the other two's last
name?
Oh, we're stuck now.
Yep.
Hoagie.
Yep. Hoagie.
And Hoagie Sandwich. And Laverne.
Laverne.
Shirley.
And Shirley.
There you go.
Right.
Laverne is a pre-med student who's a little bit off a rocker. Hoagie is a roadie for a band. And Bernard is the lovable nerd from the first Maniac Mansion.
I think he's the one character, not that you have to use because Dave was, but he's the one character that everyone picks because they know the nerd can get stuff done. He can fix the radio. He can fix the record machine. He kind of saves the day in Maniac Mansion.
Bernard gets stuff done.
Print the bumper sticker now.
They come to visit Dr. Fred, and it's kind of fun that these characters, instead of just it all being done in a cutscene, you actually get to interrupt this long intro with short playable bits as it goes on. Eventually, you find Dr. Fred's secret lab. Spoiler alert, it's inside the grandfather clock. You go downstairs. He decides, you know, here's the best way to stop Purple Tentacle. Purple Tentacle has an unstoppable plan to rule the world. The only thing we can do is travel back in time and turn off the sludge, the ooze, yesterday. That way he can't get it. So you all get in his patented Chrono-John. And can you describe those, Ben?
A Chrono-John is similar to a Porto-John, or, I mean, they have many names. Any other names?
Porto-Potty, Portolette.
Porto-Potty, Portolette. All right, thank you. It's similar in the sense that it is one, except at the top, I believe it has like a police siren, and it has an exhaust like that a car has. And that might be it.
Yeah.
The only difference. Okay.
And it's a time machine.
It's a time machine as well. If you have a diamond, a $2 million diamond.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Dr. Ed may have skimped on the diamond. And so it's a one-time use. They all get sent in different directions through time. Laverne, 200 years in the future. Hoagie, 200 years in the past. And Bernard, because he's Bernard, doesn't really go anywhere. One of the cool things that I really liked about this intro, you were talking about how it kind of like introduces you to these puzzles before you even find Dr. Ed, is that if you pick up Madden or COD or Assassin's Creed or whatever top 10 game right now, plug it into your PS4. I know that's not how games work. You plug it in.
You blow on the disc.
Start playing it. You blow on the disc, open it up a couple times, shake it out, turn it on. It's going to have a 5 to 20 minute first level of how to play the game. Or if it's Madden, it's a half hour long or whatever. I mean, it's this button to do this button to do that. I mean, these games do not have that. They throw you in on usually like a starter level, but there's no like click over here, do this. Hey, Bob, maybe you should go over here. Like it's just kind of, here it is. Here's a list of verbs in a room. Start clicking on things. And you have to. It's intuitive only because you have to be intuitive to figure it out. Like, you have to just kind of start clicking on things, and it starts making sense. You click on look at. You click on pick up. You click on the clock. You click on whatever. Open. And it usually doesn't take too long because they put you in a room that doesn't have that many objects. So let's go ahead and, before we get too much further, start jumping into kind of the puzzles and some of the gameplay. Sound good?
Yeah.
Let's talk about how this game works. Let's talk about how the
Doobie-doo.
Go for it.
Coming right back at you. I love that we have music now. I mean, things are just... Yeah. Things are rolling. So
big time.
We really are. So one of the things I think is really cool about these puzzles I mentioned earlier is the time travel element. And I think it's okay to just give away one of them because it won't solve the puzzle for you. You know what you need to do. But Laverne goes 200 years in the future. Hoagie goes 200 years in the past. And Bernard stays put. Bernard just kind of wanders around the house. Hoagie lands his chronogeon between two outhouses, which is kind of fun for comedic effect. Unfortunately, yeah. Laverne lands in a tree and can't get down. So you can't do anything with Laverne at first.
So good, yeah.
But you can see the tree that she's stuck in the past. And one of your first puzzles to complete becomes, how can I cut down this tree? How can I do something to kill this tree so that in the future it's not there and Laverne will land on the ground? Which is just kind of a fundamental thing.
That might be too much already. But yeah, you're right. I agree. It's a great setup, and it is one of the first puzzles you do. I think it's puzzle number three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think you know pretty early on that you need to get rid of this tree somehow.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. We could start talking about a couple of the puzzles and then how basically we both got to the same place, which was probably two-thirds of the way in, halfway in, where we collected everything, because that's what you do. Again, we'll mention this every single episode. You go through every room, every roof, every basement, every outside place, and you collect, you pull, you pick up, you open, you close every possible thing. You pick up the keys, you pick up the apples, you pick up the gum, the fake barf, whatever. That's like the first hour of the game, right? It's just picking up every possible thing. And then you start combining things, and you start giving things to people. Usually they don't want them. Usually, you know, you combine things. You'll put the soap in the water. You'll put the whatever, the soap on the thing. So I guess what was the thing that got you, what were some of those aha moments for you, if you have those off the top of your head, as far as like when you had everything collected and you finally were able to combine this thing and it kind of tore down like five walls you'd been up against?
Oh, man, you did that one for me when I needed a hint. I knew there's a character that has a crowbar, and I knew I had to get the crowbar from him, and I couldn't figure it out for the life of me. And the worst part is I actually knew how to do it. There's something that has to do with a door, and I had checked like 19 of the 20 doors in this thing and somehow had missed the one door that would fix everything. But yeah, getting that crowbar just was life-changing because you do a lot of things with that darn crowbar.
Yeah, yeah. The crowbar was a big one for me. I think I just had been frustrated longer than you. I think that was it. I just happened to click on more things than you. Another one that we both got stuck at was the mouse.
Yeah.
There's a cat in, I think, Hoagie's timeline playing with a little squeaky mouse, and there's a cat in Laverne's timeline that you need to distract. So it takes a while to kind of get this mouse away from the cat, and I feel like we should kind of be able to mention spoilers because it's almost pointless to not.
I agree.
But you basically press the bed that the cat that's next to the cat, it makes a squeaky noise, and the cat moves. And you go to pick over the squeaky toy, and the cat moves back. So we did that for about an hour and a half. Eventually, you figure out that you can actually pick up the whole bed and throw it across the room, and that actually moves the cat. But it was just these small things were the most frustrating things, and still probably, I would say, the only downside of these games. Even the graphics and stuff I get over pretty quickly, but these frustrating things that it seems like, I mean, 1993 was before most people had internet in their houses, and even if they did, there was no walkthroughs for these games. I mean, there's no YouTube, obviously. There's nothing that could have helped you on the internet. So I was 8 when this game came out. I don't understand how you guys figured this game out and solved this game when it came out. Can you shed a little light on kind of how you kind of tore through these puzzles?
Yeah, it was me and about 4 other friends in, I guess it would have been middle school at the time. I don't know how we were allowed to spend so much time at school playing video games, but it happened somehow. We'd go to the computer lab and play these games, and we'd each go home, and we'd share the save files. We'd put those on an external disk, and you'd take it home for the night, then you'd come back, and then somebody else would take it home.
Floppy disk.
Floppy disk, you know.
Right.
Because we were cool.
Right.
And it was great. We'd call each other to talk through things. We'd go over to somebody's house, and we'd play it together. And I remember when you'd get to school one day, and somebody would just say, dude, I got the crowbar. You'd say, what? How did that happen? So we would play this over the course of weeks and weeks and weeks,
right.
Which was the best way to play it, especially because we were only putting in half hour to an hour each night on it, and probably not playing every day. But having that sustained attention kind of dispersed among a group of friends was a great way to do it.
Yeah. I mean, and I think the thing that you, the quote, actually, we talked about this a couple days ago, and the quote that I took down from you was, LucasArts is video games for people who find video games too taxing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think is perfect for today's crowd. I think back then it was video games for people that love video games.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, some of the other games that were coming out then was Zombie Ate My Neighbors. There was obviously Mario. There was Sonic. There was other games that were more stimulating.
Yep.
But those were almost overstimulating. I think if you were to give this to someone who didn't grow up with video games, they would find this enjoyable. They would still find the puzzles really rewarding. They would find it challenging, but not overly frustrating. But, you know, so like I asked my wife to play Call of Duty. This is the third nice. Time in the past half hour I've mentioned Call of Duty. I apologize. I promise I don't play Call of Duty that much. But I had Hannah play Call of Duty with me when we first started dating. It lasted about 90 seconds, and then I think we had our first fight.
Nice.
Because it's like, shoot the guy. Just shoot the guy.
Just shoot him.
Oh, my God. Shoot him. Oh, my. We're done. Get out. I don't remember if she said get out or if I said get out, but...
Somehow you made it
with
through.
With this one... Right, and eventually we'll post this. We both had our wives play these games.
Yeah.
And while they were frustrated in the same way that we're frustrated, and they don't play video games as much as we do, but they were much more relaxed and able to think through things, and they think differently than us, and they're smarter in a lot of ways than us, obviously, so they figure out things just as quickly as we do, even though we play way more video games than they do.
Yep. Yeah, if you've ever played Call of Duty and thought to yourself, I wish this was more like a crossword puzzle.
Right.
These games are going to be more for you, more your speed.
Right, right. Slow down there. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I think another thing that you actually mentioned that I'm just going to steal, another thing that I made up from my own brain, is that these games are harder than most current video games.
Yeah.
It seems. I mean, yeah. I like we're talking about current video games, I mean, play a lot of them and you can put them on easy mode or standby mode or whatever it is and just kind of point and shoot. Or play enough just to get to the next level, which is usually what I do because I want to play the game just to kind of beat the game. I'm not in it to get a high score or to beat that 12-year-old in Berlin who's kicking my butt or whatever. But this, it really is a really, really difficult game. I haven't had to look up cheats for a game that's not a LucasArts game, I think, ever. At least not in a long, long, long time.
And one quick,
and we did end up using one or two walkthrough hints, and you'll kind of walk us through those. What were we going
to
say?
Oh, one thing that can be really helpful for the hints on these games is to use UHS, the Universal Hint yes. System, because yeah. It won't give it away. It's really, really well designed to say, so you're trying to get a ladder up there. Have you thought about what ladders are made of? Or, you know, something really ambiguous. You're like, oh, I need to get the, oh, I see now, you know. It gives you a real generous, ambiguous hint.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice. You feel a lot more rewarding because you get to figure out at least half of the hint or two-thirds of the hint rather than just someone telling you, oh, go pick this up and give this to that guy.
Yeah, for the example Ben used earlier of the squeaky bed, it was, what else squeaks?
Right.
And you go, oh, the bed squeaks. Okay, I got there.
And you still get the chance to feel really smart and really proud of yourself, which is always nice.
As well you should.
Right. Because you bought this game. You deserve it, man.
So we each thought about who's our favorite character for the game. Ben, you go first. Who's your favorite character?
I tried to go kind of random esoteric, and I was going to pick like the horse or the hamster, and I realized I did not like those characters, and they weren't really big characters. So I just went kind of a little on the nose. I went Laverne.
Yeah.
I mean, she's hilarious. She's super random and quirky, and just everything she says is kind of off the wall, and... there's almost always a subtext to what she says, which she's talking about therapy or murdering animals or whatever it might be. It's just almost always hilarious. What about you?
Yeah, first, amen to that. All three of the main characters are just really amazing, but Laverne is my favorite as well from the main characters. Yeah. But I did go esoteric. I got to go with Harold. And one of the reasons I love Harold so much, now just to kind of catch you up, this is in the future.
Harold? Really?
Harold, yeah. This is in the future where human beings are slaves to the more powerful tentacles. And Harold is in a human pageant, which is like a dog show. He's in the human show.
Right.
And I really liked that combination of what would it be like for humans to be in dog shows. And then also, what would it be like if you took a dog that was in a dog show, compared it to like a wild dog? Just all that melded together well for me, so that Harold is cross-dressing, doesn't quite know that he's cross-dressing. It's not, you know, a statement. I wouldn't call him transgender in any way. But he's just really vacuous and stupid, which is probably what a really inbred poodle would feel like. And so it's a really inbred poodle of a human being. And I enjoyed Harold. I enjoyed his bizarre fake French accent, too.
Damn it, I didn't get to experience any of that accent.
Oh,
man.
That's true. He was all, well, you're not as beautiful as I am because I am Harold.
Never stop talking like that.
I am Harold.
Okay, stop now.
Oh, Harold.
Favorite puzzle. I think my favorite aspect of the puzzling of this game and most of the Scum games is the fact that they all kind of weave into one big ball of puzzle yarn, where at first I was going to say, oh, the puzzle where you get, and spoilers, if you want to play this game, stop right here. But here we go. Where you get the skunk, put him in prison, scares the humans out. Really, really clever. It was really hard to get the cat to paint us, you know, to look like a skunk, then to get the cat toy. And then I kept going back. I was like, oh, how did I get that? And how did I get that? And I was like, oh, you had to win the pageant, and then you had to get the spaghetti, and you had to get the fork in order to get her hair, and you had to laugh. Like, there's so many intricate things just to get this cat toy and to get this cat painted white, to get out of the prison, to get, because the whole thing you needed to, in order to win, was the night at Club Tentacle to give to the prison guard to get the humans out of there. So there's just so many things that you have to do in order just to get these guys out of there, which is all of that is in order to get the human hunter. I think, I don't know if that's his,
yep,
the human tentacle hunter,
yep,
human hunter tentacle, away from the clock. So you can go on the clock and use your chronogen again. It's just so intricately wound. Yes. And just clever. Clever is almost too tiny of a word, but it is just really, really smart and well done.
Yeah, I agree. And mine is similar in that it was really involved, and you got to think back to, there's a gag convention where there's, you know, those prank toys like whoopee cushions and stuff like that. There's guns involved and murder, suicidal convention goer. But the payoff is that you get to blow George Washington's teeth out of his mouth.
Yeah,
and that's really, really satisfying.
Really is.
Also that someone can start a fire.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole room. I found that I really liked – this would be a good question. I don't know if it's a question. I'm just going to start talking. I really liked being in Hoagie's timeline because I felt like I kept finding new things. But I felt safe in Bernard's because I felt like I just knew, because that was the present time. I'd already tried everything. There wasn't as much new stuff to try. And then in Laverne's timeline, I was just always frustrated.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yep. I totally buy that.
Is that about sums
that,
it up?
That sounds okay, right. Yeah. And you said you felt safe in Bernard's. I always felt scared in Laverne's that I was going to get caught again.
Oh, for the first half an hour. Yes, yeah. Totally.
Yep.
Yeah, that's true. I think the one of the puzzles I remembered from the first one, I think one of the two that I remembered from 20 years ago when we played was taking the tentacle diagram. Was it a...
anatomy chart.
Anatomy, thank you. Taking the anatomy chart of the tentacle, sending it in the chronogen back to Hoagie, him giving it to Betsy Ross.
Yep.
And then her making that the flag and then using the flag as the tentacle suit. I mean, the game is just freaking
so
clever,
it's
dude.
It's so good.
God, man. But if I hadn't, I don't know how long that would have taken me to figure out if I had never played this game before. I can't even imagine. It would have haunted me. All right. So if we're all done with gameplay, Jason, I have two questions for you.
This game's pretty fun. With frustration, when I was all done, I just had two questions. What's the beer, what's the song? I can't always tell, I just wanna know, what game is West D12?
It's so good.
All
it's
right, so good. Two questions. What's the beer? What's the song? You want to go first?
Sure. Can't wait to hear what your answers are. Maybe we should each do beer and then we'll each do song.
I like it.
So my beer was Palo Santo Marone. This is made by Dogfish Head. And I chose it because it's a complex beer that you got to spend some time with. In fact, the bottle even tells you might want to throw it in the basement for a couple months before you drink it because it ages really well. And I think Day of the Tentacle is kind of best played the same way. You get into it and then you wait a little while. Go think about it. Go take a walk. Hang out with friends for a while. Come back to it in a week and things will start to unlock for you. And also it just tastes really good. That's the other thing. It's really enjoyable. And Day of the Tentacle is certainly that.
I like that. And we should make a point to have that beer, have us drinking that beer. I actually have a Palo in my fridge about 10 feet away from me.
Oh, man. We got to do that then.
Maybe next time. But we can't get the following drink that I'm going to say because it costs, I think, $400. And it also is never – it's out of commission. They don't make it anymore.
Is it a Sam Adams?
No. Oh, I wish, man. No. But actually, I don't wish because this beer sounds amazing. You and I have never had it. We will never have it. But it's BrewDog's End of History. Which is the reason I chose it. It's a 55% alcohol beer, which makes it about 15% more alcohol than most bourbons have, most whiskeys. And it's served in a taxidermied squirrel's body.
Or sometimes a stoat.
Yes, thank you. A stoat, which if you don't know what that is, just Google BrewDog's End of History, and you'll see many a stoat.
Many a stoat.
But the reason I chose that was it's a very difficult game. It's a very difficult beer to find. Very rewarding. This beer is reviewed as being very high, very highly reviewed, I mean. And then it's also just pushing the boundaries like this game was at the time. I mean, story-wise, graphic-wise, everything. It was just kind of pushing the boundaries. Obviously, a 55% beer is pushing the boundaries. Jay, do you have a song for this game?
Well, before we get on to that, I'd like to say that End of History is also inching very dangerously close to animal cruelty, just like this game does. But as I understand it, all of the rodents used in End of History died natural deaths. They lived long, full lives before being taxidermied around a beer bottle.
Thank you for that. All right. You got a song for this game?
I sure do. So this song I chose, just a little preface to it. The main connection is nostalgia. It's a song that always feels good to me. And that was the feeling that I had coming back to Day of the Tentacle was every puzzle, everything I clicked on just felt nice and it felt like coming home. So here's our song.
Dude, great song. Great selection.
So that song was Mass Pike by the Get Up Kids.
Oh, just a classic.
Yeah.
And mine had actually nothing to do with nostalgia or coming home or anything. Mine was just what's a fun, quirky, smart song that's almost a guilty pleasure, just like really catchy. And it's by actually Tegan and Sarah, which was one of my favorite bands in high school. It's also done by, or it's also written and performed by Lonely Island, which is Andy Samberg, Akiva, and Jorma, those funny guys, and produced by Mark Mothersbaugh, who did the Rugrats theme song. He was the lead singer in Devo. He did a bunch of countless shows and films and video games and soundtracks and theme songs. Jay, do you even know the name of the song yet?
No, I'm so excited. I mean,
wait,
Tegan
you know
and Sarah, Lonely Island, and okay. Mark Mothersbaugh. Right. This is impressive. I'm so excited.
Right? As soon as I found out this song was by them, I loved the song.
Wow.
Like, I was intrigued when I first heard it, and then I loved it.
I know it! It just hit me. Is it Everything is Awesome?
Everything is awesome.
Yes!
Everything is cool when you're part of the team. Everything is awesome when we live in our dream. Everything is better when we sing.
Oh! So good. It's so perfect.
Right?
I especially love that everything's cool when you're part of a team, which is...
It is.
I mean, that's Day of the Tentacle.
Which is true. I should have brought that up, but great. I meant that.
That's what you meant, clearly.
Pick the song. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that actually kind of does it, unless you have anything else on Dot, as the cool kids call it.
Well, I think we need to talk about a little special someone that we haven't talked about yet.
I think you're right. I think it's time for...
Chuck is a player, but he's so much more than that. I said, Chuck's not only a player, he's an NPC in Champ.
All right, Jay. Chuck is not only a plant, he's an NPC in Champ. I don't know if it, Chuck the plant, for all of you LucasArts lovers out there, you scumites, scummers, scum, what do you call them?
Scumlets.
But that's not what people listening are called. So you people who like these games know that Chuck the plant is a recurring character. And Jason and I were talking, we did a lot of research actually. We did research separately, into kind of where Chuck came from. You want to kind of take it and kind of what you learned about his past?
Well, yeah. And, you know, we covered in the Maniac Mansion podcast just where he'd come from originally. But, you know, where has he been since Maniac Mansion, since our last game that we talked about him in? And so I looked into it. And I hope that my research doesn't contradict yours at all. I really think it's pretty solid. Turns out that Chuck actually decided to see the world after Maniac Mansion. I think a lot of crazy stuff went down. And so he backpacked across Asia to really discover himself, and it shows up. I think you see it in Day of the Tentacle. There's a lot of development in him as a character, some more depth. He's maybe harder to touch, harder to get to, a little bit, you know, spikier, you know, pokier, stay away. But that's because he's got a lot more introspection. He's got a lot more going on inside.
Interesting. Really? Wow. So then he just found himself in the mansion again.
Well, yeah. No, he returned home afterwards after a long trip, like you do. I mean, but he came home, you know, really was it the same Chuck the plant that came back? And I think that's what he learned. In the words of Basho, do not follow in the footsteps of the master, but instead seek what they sought. And when Chuck did that, he returned to find himself home, but it was a new Chuck that had returned.
Wow. Well, that's actually a little different than what I found.
Okay, that'll be interesting. I'm puzzled, but okay.
I'm interested in where you found that, because I found a website actually called Chuck the Plant, Where Have You Been the Past 6 Years, .org.com. So, and what I found out was actually he just re-released a book recently, written with a couple other M6 operatives, which is actually what he was at the time. He's retired now, luckily, so he's out of the business. But at the time, he was looking for a Serbian militant hacker, I believe, in southern Tennessee. And during that gunfight car chase to find the hacker, who's really good at driving and shooting, he actually killed Chuck's wife, unfortunately. Oh. So he's after that, Chuck kind of lost control, went completely rogue, off the map, off the grid even. Off the grid of the map, up like past the numbers and letters of the map, and just got lost in this mansion, just lost himself in the mansion, and then got lost in the mansion, just waiting to someday avenge his dead wife's life and hopefully kind of get back on his roots again.
Can I just tell you how excited I am for the remastered version when we get to see a much closer look at Chuck the Plant? I think the graphics are going to make a big difference here.
No, how could they not? How could they not? Yeah, it's going to be amazing. The more pixels, the more Chuck. We all want it.
Yeah, and you mentioned you used a website. I mean, that's cool and all. I actually used the I Ching to just get in tune with his spirit and find out what was going on there.
Wow. Well, fair enough. I guess it's probably the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Maybe somewhere in between.
Right. So, okay, I think it's time we talk about the last thing we're going to talk about today, I promise, is the next game we're going to do. We don't know exactly when this is coming out. We're trying to build a little library before we let them all out. But our homework was to pick 3 non-adventure games. Our plan right now is to kind of to alternate kind of between the Scum adventure point-and-click games as well as the other LucasArts games. We don't want to necessarily just like blaze through all of these beloved Scum games and then do another chunk of games that aren't that. We want to kind of mix and match. So, our homework was to pick 3 non-adventure games. Jay, you want to say your 3 first?
Sure. And if we ever overlap in one of our 3, that's just the next one automatically.
I think so.
But what I want you to do is choose one of my 3 that you like, and I'll choose one of your 3, and then we'll talk it out.
Sounds good.
First up, Super Star Wars for the Super good. Nintendo Entertainment System.
So good.
One caveat to that is that it's an impossible game to play.
True.
Night Shift, That I had completely forgotten about, but I noticed when I was flipping through.
Oh yeah, that's the game that where they all like worked in the court, and there was like the really funny judge and like the blonde guy.
Oh yeah,
and he was really funny. Who? I used to watch that on USA all the time. Who? After Wings.
Bull.
Bull. He was the bull.
Oh,
right?
Bull. Yeah.
And, okay.
Yeah, John Larroquette. Oh, anyway,
you do not know that actor's
well,
name.
Well, yeah. That wasn't Bull, but he was the funny. He had a couple shows. Man. I mean, John Larroquette. He's a guy. Okay. No, Night Shift was this kind of puzzle game LucasArts made, where you're assembling robots, something. Where it'd be like the head of Indiana Jones, the body of R2-D2, and the feet of Howard the Duck. And you worked for
what?
I know you worked for Industrial Might and Logic. Was the company. Solid. That you Solid. Worked for. You worked the night shift, and something had gotten broke with the machine, and you had to fix it. And then it turned into just some kind of puzzle game.
What year did it come out? Do you know?
I believe 93. I believe same year as Day of the Tentacle.
I feel like every great LucasArts game came out in 93. Because so did Sam & Max. So did Zombies Ate My Neighbors. Yep. I'm sure there was a Monkey Island that came out that year.
And that reminds me of my third on the list.
Oh, no.
Zombies Ate My Neighbors.
There we go. Sorry about that.
So there you go.
Nice.
Which I will just say, whenever we do that show, it'll be a fun time to talk about testing the games, because we did actually test those games, Zombies Ate My Neighbors.
Yeah.
And that was a blast.
I think that one, and then was it Rogue Squadron?
Yeah.
Or Rogue? No. TIE Fighter was the other one that I remember testing. Again, I was like 8, so it probably was above my demographic, but you guys let me join you guys.
Rebel Assault.
Was that it?
I thought it was Rebel Assault.
Rebel Assault was the Doom clone?
Mm-hmm. No, that was Dark Forces.
Man. Damn it, dude. There are so many Star Wars games, mm-hmm. and they're so similar. Mm-hmm. Okay, so yes, you're right, because my first one is Dark Forces.
Yep.
Because I saw Doom clone, and I was like, yep, that's what I want to do. I played a demo a couple weeks ago, and I want more of that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, came out in 95, Dark Forces. Second one is Grim Fandango.
Oh, yes.
A little later in the run.
Wait, that's an adventure game. Schafer. You son of a... Hey.
Is it...
It is. You don't get no.
Well, I picked two non-adventure games this week. My other one is Zombies Ate My Neighbors, which I guess is what we're going to be playing this next couple weeks. So we're going to need, we're going to need SNES controllers, aren't we?
Blow off your SNES, get it out of the closet.
Yeah. Geez.
Plug it in, boot it up, and practice your cheat codes. Get your Game Genie ready, because I think there are over 100 levels.
Dude.
It's pretty fantastic.
I'm happy, but I'm also sad, because this might mean we might not come out with another pod for a while. This might take us a few weeks.
It's going to be a fun few weeks, though.
True. This is true. And that is a game, another game that just brings a lot of good memories back. And there actually is a Maniac Mansion, or no, a Day of the Tentacle level in Zombies Ate My Neighbor. So you got a nice little transition, a little segue there. So anything else for today's pod from you?
I got nothing else. I hope, though, that next time we'll be able to include some emails from our listeners, from our great fan base.
Oh, they are fantastic, too. And just like the rest of our great fan base, you can email us at molmfpod@gmail.com. You can check out our website, which is menoflowmoralfiber.com. And there you can see links to our Twitter, our Facebook, our Instagram, where you can like and favorite and do all these cool things people do on social media. And you can kind of follow, see what we're doing in between episodes there. All right. Well, I think that about does it for today's dot episode. I have been Ben.
And I will be Jason.
And I am a mighty pirate.
It's been more fun than a jumpsuit full of weasels.
See you guys.